Good morning, everybody. How are we doing? Awesome. Well, you know, when I grew up, you know, I was born 67, so I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and one of the big threats, right, was this Cold War we had with Russia. And you always, you know, the Russian nation, you know, we're on the verge of World War III, nuclear war. And so your tendency, given the narrative that we were taught during those times, was that everybody in Russia, you know, they're evil, right? They're against us. They all hate us. It's probably kind of the same way, you know, a generation before we felt about Nazi Germany, right? They're evil. All the atrocities that they perpetrated, and everybody was complicit in there. And you just tend to sort of group the whole, right? With, you know, everybody in there with the national sort of view that we have and this portrayed of them. But then the stories come out, right? That, you know, not everybody was on board with what Hitler was doing. Obviously, we have Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, who was against what Hitler was doing. And you get, you know, movies like Schindler's List, and you see people that were out there trying to help save the Jews. And these stories come out. And as we read through the book of Judges right now, you can't help but go, you know, the same thing. You want to just put this idea of, okay, everybody in Israel is really just, they don't want anything to do with God. They're doing their own thing. In fact, that's how the book of Judges starts, right? It tells us nobody was following God. They didn't know about God, and they were doing what was right in their own eyes. And so we've been told this, and so we kind of maybe have a tendency to look at the people of Israel at this time as just apostates. They're all that way. But then we get to the book of Ruth, and we get a glimpse of the faithfulness and the loyalty to God that was still there, and it is just a little bright, shining moment. And when we get to it, which you're going to get to it on the 8th of April this year, you're going to read it in one day. It's a short book, but it's got some great, great little nuggets for us to take away from. So let's dive in to the book of Ruth, a little mosaic of Ruth with her gleaning sheaves. I'm sure you all gleaned this week for your bread, right? All right. Well, let's start out some fun facts about Ruth. Fun. They're fun facts. We got five of them. I'm sure there's more, but I chose five. So here we go. You know, of course, you probably know this. It's one of only two books named after women, Esther being the other one. So I love the symmetry and the parallels and the juxtapositions, right? We've got Esther, a Hebrew woman who married a Gentile king. There she is there. That's with Haman down there. And then God used Esther to save the Jewish nation. And we've got Purim. You guys all celebrated Purim at the beginning of March last month, right? No. Okay. You didn't make your homentashen and cast your lot? No. Okay. Anyway, but that Purim, they celebrate every year to commemorate that salvation that God provided through Esther. And then you've got Ruth, a Gentile woman who marries a Hebrew man, and God used Ruth to perpetuate the line of the Messiah, and, you know, we celebrate that line of Messiah every Easter, so we get to do that next weekend. But there's fun fact number one. Fun fact number two, she's not just a woman, but she's a Gentile woman that the book of the Bible is named after, and she's a Moabite. Now, I don't know if you remember the Moabites and who Moab was, but Moab was the son of Lot's oldest daughter. You remember how he was born? He was the son of an incestuous relationship. You remember, right? The Sodom and Gomorrah, that's where they're living. They come out of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot's wife gets turned into a pillar of salt because she looked back, and now Lot and his two daughters are alone, living in a cave, and the daughters, hey, we're never going to have a family. I got a great idea. Let's get our father drunk, and we'll sleep with him, and he'll bear us children. And they do that, one after the other, two nights in a row, and the issue of that oldest daughter was Moab. And it's not moving forward. Cool. So Moab is the leader of the Moabites that we are Ruth is where she's from. So also Moab, right? Israel had to fight King Sihon and Og in Moab in Numbers 21. And I don't know why it's not working. Not advancing. Doesn't want to go. And Balak, he was the king of Moab. He hired Balaam to curse Israel. And that was in Numbers 21. Sorry, guys. This is going to be a long day if it's not going to work. So we're going to try this again. There we go. All right. Balak. And then you've got just where in our time right now, we just read about this, right? You've got King Eglon. He was of Moab. He is oppressing Israel for 18 years in the beginning of Judges there. That's where Ehud was their deliverer, and he takes his sword, right? He stabs big fat Eglon, and sword fat wraps around the hilt of the sword, and he leaves him there in a ignominious setting there. So you've got Moab that is, you know, Moab not the greatest, you know, to Israel. So this is where, you know, your background for Ruth here. So fun fact number three, the plot doesn't really revolve around Ruth. It actually is more, when you read the book, I mean, it's more about Naomi in terms of subject and plot. Ruth just happens to be the direct object, so to speak, of, you know, she's the one doing all the doing that the action is being done to, right, and providing, and so it's not really really doesn't revolve around there, because we talk about Elimelech, right? That's Naomi's husband and his family name that's going to be preserved. It's Naomi's land that will be purchased and redeemed, and there's Naomi. This is great. This is Chagall, right? Chagall actually painted a bunch of scenes from the Book of Ruth, so you're going to enjoy those with me today. I love the reality of his paintings, right? There's just so the sharp detail, and I'm joking, as of course you know. That's Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah there, in case you couldn't figure that out. Anyway. And it's funny, because of the three main characters, Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz, Ruth actually speaks the least amount. She has the least amount of dialogue in the book. And then Boaz has the most dialogue. That's Boaz with Ruth, by the way. Also Chagall. You knew that, right? You don't understand the rabbit holes I go down when I'm starting to prepare for some of these. It's quite fascinating, and things you find. But yeah, from a subject plot, it would be more about Naomi. From a, you know, from a talking and dialogue standpoint, it'd be more about Boaz. So it's interesting, but the book is named Ruth. Naomi has the second most dialogue, but Ruth is the one they use to accomplish all these things. If Naomi is the subject and Boaz is the verb, then Ruth would be the direct object. I don't know. It's the English major in me that wants to go that direction. There you go. All right, fun fact number four. Did you know this is read annually by Orthodox Jews on the Feast of Pentecost? You knew that? Wow, okay, I didn't. I thought it was just new to me. This is also the Feast of Harvest that you find in Exodus 23. There's another painting by, I think that's Rembrandt, of Ruth gleaning. Also called the Day of First Fruits, it was a harvest time celebration. Pentecost, we know, is 50th, right? 50th day, and it's the 50th day from the second day of Passover that they celebrate it. We also know Pentecost from Acts, where the Holy Spirit comes upon the apostles on the day of Pentecost. They were there all in Jerusalem for the feast of Pentecost, the Feast of Harvest, the Day of First Fruits. And we commemorate that also with the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. And this is when Ruth's betrothal would have taken place. And so because of that, they read the book of Ruth on the Feast of Harvest, so on Pentecost. So there you go. You remember she comes back, when they all come back, well, Ruth didn't come back, she's going there for the first time, but when they go to Bethlehem, it's during barley harvest. So that's fun fact number four. I know you were excited about that one. This is one of the least contested manuscripts in the Hebrew canon. Interesting, huh? It was accepted very early on, recognized very early on. There are hardly any manuscript variations of it. And we know Jesus, you know, when he affirms the Hebrew scriptures, he does one verse he does this in is in Luke 11:15. It says, from the blood of Abel, he's talking to the Pharisees here, from the blood of Abel, Genesis, to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary, that's from the book of Chronicles. And in the Hebrew canon, Genesis was the first book, Chronicles was the second book. And he's kind of, you know, this is one passage where he's affirming all of the Hebrew canon at the time. And he doesn't say, except for the book of Ruth, or except for the book of Esther, right? He doesn't, you know, those were all included at that time. And so, you know, he's not making exceptions. So we get some sort of a New Testament affirmation of the canonicity of Ruth in the Hebrew scriptures. And to boot, we've got four fragments of Ruth that were found at Qumran, which actually shows a little bit about how important they thought that book was. Of such a small book, to find that many fragments of it, four separate fragments. So they'd copied it over a couple of times. And again, these fragments are, there is virtually no difference from the Masoretic texts, which is that Greek Byzantine line that there's a lot of they've just got a lot of that big family of manuscript evidence, and there's very little difference in there. So there you go. The language used is a rather simple Hebrew. It's a simple story. It's a great little story. It's very well rounded, but it's simple. And it's simple Hebrew language. In fact, they use this book in beginning Hebrew classes, biblical Hebrew classes, to start translating with. I don't remember them using it when I was taking Hebrew at Talbot. They didn't use this one. I think ours were way more complex. At least it felt like it. So maybe they should have used, I would have liked it if they would have used the book of Ruth. That would have been helpful. So anyway, there you go. Fun fact number five. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of background and some information there about Ruth as we dive in here. So let's talk a little bit about the author and date. So the book of Ruth, it actually doesn't provide really any clue to who the author might be. The Talmud attributes it to Samuel as the writer, and contemporary scholars will say Samuel, some will say Nathan, some will say David wrote it, some will say Solomon, some will say it was written during the time of Hezekiah or the time of Josiah. These were times of rebirth, renewal in Israel, so that there was this sort of a renaissance of religion as they come back to God. You know, Josiah finds the scroll, the law in the temple. And so there might have been, they argue that it might have been written then. Some even go far as to say it was written during the time of the Babylonian exile, or even after that, post-exilic time, as a story of hope and faithfulness, but also as an apologetic sometimes, if it was written about the line of David, right? So some will say, these are scholars saying this, that they had to give a reason for why in the line of David, the king of Israel, there was a prostitute, Rahab, and a Moabitess, Ruth. And so this is one aspect of that, why they would say that. Some of the language in there is very similar to 1 and 2 Samuel, as well as 1 and 2 Kings. we attribute 1 and 2 Samuel to be written by Samuel, and so there, and so those hints are, tend to then push towards Samuel, and it had couldn't have been written, you know, when it was when the action takes place, which we'll get to when the action takes place, because you've got things like they identify these older Jewish customs, like the giving of the sandal to consummate that land deal or the kinsman redeemer deal in chapter 4 there. They had to say it was an older Jewish custom, right? Like, now this was the custom in former times in Israel, as if that had been forgotten. So some period of time would have had to have passed, so it couldn't have been, you know, at that time. Plus, you've got the genealogy that ends with David. So we know that it has to at least probably been written around David, you know, in the time of David as the earliest writing of it. But in terms of how late the writing is, you know, it goes all the way. I mean, if you think about, you know, the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonian Empire in 586, they're in exile, you know, call it 550, and here we are with David. He's king in Hebron in 1010. I mean, it's like a 500-year span of, okay, when was Ruth written? So just reading everything I read, I was sort of falling in the line of, you know, Samuel writing it. You know, you've got that the Talmudic choice of Samuel authorship, some of the hints of the language, and the genealogy ending with David seems to make a lot of sense in Samuel could have been the author. But again, these are all surmises. Well, it's educated guesses for them. It's me just using all their information. So anyway, author and date. So has enough time passed? I mean, one of the questions, right, is has enough time passed for these customs to be forgotten? This custom of the sandal, things like that. So when did the story of Ruth take place? So there's a couple of choices. Some people say that it was taking place during the time of Gideon, which would be around 1130s BC. We're talking in generalities here. The others say maybe even in the time of Ehud in 1280 BC. So you need to remember here, Boaz, do you remember who his father was and his mother was? Rahab and Salmon, okay? Well, Rahab was the time of the fall of Jericho with Joshua, and Salmon would have been at that, you know, around that time. That's a long time ago from 1130. I mean, that's a couple hundred years back. So if Boaz is what? How old is he? 100? 200? I mean, the dates become difficult if it's during the time of Gideon. It makes more sense maybe to be during the time of Ehud. So here's one timeline. This one has Ruth in the time of Gideon there. You can see that on there, the 1150 to 1110 time frame. And, you know, here's Ehud down here, okay? And then way back here is where, you know, the fall of Jericho would have been. So it might get a little tough. This one is a different chronology. And it's got Ruth falling in, this is the Ruth stuff right here, falling in the time of Ehud, somewhere in there. That gives a time frame of about 87 years if you average out per generation to get from Salmon to David, you know, because anytime you move it too far, you get these, you know, these patriarchs that are, or these lines of Judah, they're going to be 150 years old having kids, and it doesn't seem reasonable when we're seeing the ages of the people in the Bible at this particular time. So this one might make more sense, but we don't really know. But this kind of gives you a little sense of, you know, the two different things. And I'm telling you, it is a rabbit hole. I started doing, you know, timelines myself. Okay, this amount of years, this amount of, it went down a lot of rabbit holes. But anyway, it's an interesting study. If you ever want to do that, you can start reading all the times of oppression, the times of peace in the book of Judges, and, you know, you can work your way backwards and see if you can figure it out. It's educational. Anyway, there you go. So this is where we were talking about, remember, we're talking about how can customs be forgotten, you know, and thinking about when this could have been written. So David begins his reign in Hebron in 1010, right? So you're looking at a period of at least 120 to 270 years in the past from when this would have been written, if it was written during the time of David, okay? Have we forgotten any customs? Think about that. Beginning of the 19th century. Let's just go to the beginning of the 19th century, about 120 years ago, all right, which would be the earliest this would be, or the soonest this would be one. Any customs or practices that were happening during that time that we would might maybe have to explain to the youth of today, or to, you know, readers and listeners of today? Probably. How about this one? You got an infection? We're going to put some leeches on it. Or we're going to do some bloodletting. They were doing that in the early 1900s. So I don't think we're doing that. But you might have to explain that to somebody. Why on earth were you putting leeches on a on an infected area of your body? That doesn't make any sense. Well, I understand what the process was. Anyway. Cigarettes. Did you know they were a cure for asthma when they came out? Cure for asthma. Try and explain that one to the kids of the day. Anybody have to measure the hem of their dress? Yeah. How about those high schoolers come in? I'm going to give you all a tape measure. When the high schoolers come in at the end of this, we're going to measure the hem of their dresses. If they're even wearing dresses, they're probably wearing, you know, leggings, and that's a whole different issue. But the point is, we're not measuring the hem of the dress, and you'd probably have to explain that, right? How about relationally? Courting, you know? You'd have to explain that. We don't see that anymore. Now we just, they go on Tinder, I guess. So, you know, if you don't have that app, they go get a date. There you go. Anyway, things that we would have to explain. So it's not too far-fetched, I'm just saying, even if it was written during the time of Gideon, of the time past, that we could say, hey, it was written during the time of David. It seems to make sense. All right. Let's talk about some of the themes of the book of Ruth. Of course, we've got God's faithfulness and loyalty on display, as it is throughout the Bible. He's continuing his fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant through this book, and through the preservation of the line of Judah as well. You know, we're going to make a great nation. Yeah, we got some of that in the time of Joshua, but we haven't fulfilled that Abrahamic covenant there, so we're still going there. We've got that blessing to Judah at the end of Genesis, where the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Well, that hasn't even happened yet, right? We don't have a line of Judah as a king, all right, of leading or ruling in Israel. So that's going to keep going. We see that faithfulness and obedience is rewarded. And we look at Deuteronomy 28, 1 and 2, let me read that to you. And if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord for your God. We see that on display as well in the book of Ruth. We've got God's faithfulness. We've got faithfulness and obedience being rewarded by God. We've got redemption going on. In our book, in our story, it's along the lines of the kinsman redeemer and the leveret marriage. Lever is Latin for husband's brother. It does not have anything to do with the tribe of Levi, as we talk about that. And that's the marrying of a brother's widow to carry on his line and his inheritance that we see in the book. We also have God's ongoing redemption. Again, Deuteronomy 7:8, but it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery. There's a great verse of God's redemption from them, from Israel, but his ongoing redemption as they're getting ready there in Deuteronomy to enter the promised land. So we've got that going on. God's faithfulness and loyalty of the people being rewarded. They got redemption of people going on by God, and this deliverer rescue carrying on the family line. And then Deuteronomy 25 is 5 and 6 is where that leveret marriage is described in the law. And of course, it's a foreshadowing of Jesus as our ultimate Redeemer. And we see the line of David being carried on, and we know, obviously, that the Messiah is going to come from the line of David. And so we've got that foreshadowing of Jesus, our ultimate Redeemer. And of course, overarching all of this, covering all of this, is God's hesed love, his steadfast love that we see through that, and even being displayed by our people in the main characters in the book of Ruth. So as an outline, we've got the setting that takes place in the first five verses of the book. The last part of the book, we've got the return of Naomi to Bethlehem. Chapter 2 is all about gleaning, so if you were ever wondering how to glean, there you go. Chapter 3, we've got Ruth's acceptance by Boaz. And then in chapter 4, we've got this section on legal matters. And then we've got love and marriage and children in the last section there. So let's dive in and look at those a little bit more closely, the setting. So in the days when the judges ruled, right, so we know when it's taking place, and we just talked about a little bit of that, right? We got a lot of apostasy and evil, this cycle, right, of falling away from God, disobeying God, God punishing them, people crying out to God, God providing a redeemer in the form of a judge, and then we've got peace in the land, and then we rinse and repeat multiple times in the book of Judges. That's what's going on. There's a famine in Bethlehem during the time of Judges. Remember, Bethlehem in Hebrew means house of bread. Kind of ironic that we've got a famine in Bethlehem, in the house of bread. But also just an indication of, you know, the absence of God's blessing during this time, in the time of a famine. So we've got Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion. They go to Moab because there's grain, you know, they've heard there's food there, and you can see their journey around the north side of the Dead Sea and down into Moab, where they are going to find food. And of course, Elimelech dies in Moab, and then the two remaining sons, they take Moabite wives, Orpah and Ruth. And then after 10 years, both sons have died. We don't know if they, you know, probably didn't die right at all, both at the same time, but some point during that time of that 10-year period, both sons are dead. And so that's just the first five verses. You know, we get all of that going on, pretty nuts. And then we got left over is Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth in that section. So we've got the return. So the famine, they find out in Israel, is over, right? And Naomi decides to return to Bethlehem. And so we're going to go back. Orpah is going to go back to her family, and Ruth is going to stay with Naomi. I believe that's a William Blake etching of that scene. There's Orpah leaving. Anyway, they return to Bethlehem, and the town is stirred. So they remember Naomi, and there's a stir. And we'll get into all of that fun stuff. So section 3, we've got the gleaning section. So Ruth is gleaning in the field of Elimelech's relative Boaz. And Boaz takes notice of Ruth and favors her. And then Naomi, when she comes back, Naomi tells her that this is one of their redeemers. It's interesting if you look at the beginning of that section, right? She says, we've got a relative, and Ruth is the one that says, I will go glean in his field. She gleans, she gets, you know, has a good day gleaning, and comes back, and that's when he says he's one of our nearest redeemers at the end of that chapter. All right. Chapter 3, section 4 is the acceptance time. So Ruth returns back to the field of Boaz, and that's that scene where he goes to sleep, she identifies where he sleeps, she uncovers his feet, and then sleeps at his feet. essentially, he wakes up and then she requests, insists that he fulfill his redeemer duties. I mean, I say insists because that's kind of the way she puts it. I mean, it's incumbent upon you. This is God's law that you redeem us, and, you know, by telling him that you are one of our redeemers. So I say request, but, you know, it can be a little bit insistent. You're using God's law to say, hey, I need you to do what you're supposed to be doing. But Boaz, he gratefully accepts that responsibility and then gives her a large measure of grain to take back with her there. But he tells her there's a closer redeemer that exists and that he needs to be faced. So then we get to the legal matters in the first part of chapter 4. So Boaz goes to the city gate. This is a place where legal matters are heard and handled during this time. And he addresses this close redeemer of his responsibility to Naomi and Ruth. But the closer redeemer refuses, and Boaz is going to accept his redeemer duty and consummates the agreement with the exchange of a sandal. And here you have my stinky shoe. There you go. And then the last section, we've got love and marriage and children. Boaz and Ruth marry. That's Rembrandt that did those two images of Boaz and Ruth, and probably more to the point, right? We get the sense that Boaz is an older man, but when you start thinking about the age, he was probably in his 90s, somewhere in that neighborhood, you know, and Ruth probably not as, and probably, you know, younger, obviously. So when he's talking about, you didn't go after younger men in that book, you guys aren't as probably familiar with it. Well, you'll see it on April 8th. When you get to that point, he says, you didn't go after younger men. Well, this is probably what he looked like, and that's probably, you know, she was probably, you know, very much way, way younger. So you can understand his surprise at that. And of course, Chagall's take on the Boaz and Ruth, just for you. I do these things for you. Ruth is going to give birth to a child, and then you get a short genealogy of David in there. So so that's just kind of the structure and how it lays out. But I want to think about this thematically in just sort of how the action progresses. There's this poverty to riches spectrum that we go on, this emptiness to fullness spectrum that we get, right? Emptiness. We've got Naomi, right? She's lost her husband. She's lost her two sons. And she has not a lot in Moab at this point, right? She went away full and she came back empty is what she tells them when she returns to Bethlehem. And so much so that she names herself Mara, which means bitter. God is bitter with me. She feels that emptiness. And you can kind of sense that, right? She's a widow who has lost not only her husband, but her two sons that you would hope would help out. I mean, you get that. I mean, as my parents are getting older, I mean, there's me and my two other brothers and my sister. We're helping out our parents as they need help. You don't have that. Now, she's got her daughters-in-law, but she sent them away, or she tried to send them away. She sent Orpah away, and she went, but Ruth obviously stayed with her. But really, they've got nothing, no way to make a living. So you can sense that emptiness in her. She has nothing. But then these four chapters, the fullness, right? The sense of food, right? We got our daily bread on our plate. And you see that right away in chapters 2 and in 3. She's got family, right? She recognizes that she's got a redeemer in Boaz, and she's got family. And she's going to get redemption, as we progress through this. And ultimately, she's going to see her daughter-in-law get married, and she's going to see children or grandchildren for Naomi in this. And you could say the same for Ruth, right? She's got something in Moab, right? A husband, a life, and then she's got nothing. And she leaves, as we find, right? She leaves everything she knows, her family, and goes with Ruth. She's got nothing, and she gets a life, a marriage, a family. as I was reading this, I couldn't help but seeing, you know, this bookend of faithfulness, right? We start with the faithfulness of Ruth at the very beginning, right? She's fully committed to Naomi, right? And that these great verses, right at the start, right? Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. She is fully committed, faithfully, fully committed. And this is the first bookend of this book. And then you've got, just thinking about the character of Ruth in general, right? She's industrious. You know, she gets out, she's gleaning, she's working, right? And even Boaz sees that, right? She's loving. She obviously has a love that's overarching for Naomi to go and do this, and she's worthy, right? Talk about this, her character, right? All that you have done for your mother-in-law, this is Boaz talking, since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. I mean, Boaz is recognizing, and it's being talked about, being, you know, fully told. I mean, look what she did. So there's definitely some, you know, they're seeing the character of Ruth here. And then worthy, right? Again, in chapter 3, he says, and now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And that word, those two words that are used there, those are the same words you see in Proverbs 12:4 and 31:10 for an excellent wife. I mean, Ruth is a Proverbs 31 woman, right? That's the kind of connection that is being made here regarding Ruth's character. There's our one bookend of faith. We also have the faithfulness of Boaz, okay? Boaz was faithful to God's law. He fulfilled what he was supposed to do according to the law. And here he is in his the big speech after he's consummated, you know, the deal with the nearer redeemer. He says, you are witness this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. I mean, Boaz has his faithfulness there of sticking to God's law. And he did it joyfully, right? He did it with not just obedience, but with joy. I mean, he seemed eager to fulfill the law in that regard. So you've got that bookend of Ruth's faithfulness, and then at the end, you see that bookend of Boaz's faithfulness. And I just love the way the symmetry of that works out in the book of Ruth. Let's talk about a little blast from the past. You see the faithfulness of Boaz, but at the end of chapter 4, we're gonna invoke the Judah and Tamar comments as well in the women who come and praise Naomi and after Ruth is married and has children. But Judah and Tamar, you remember, or maybe you don't, but Tamar had to trick Judah to fulfill his duty, right? Tamar was married to Judah's son who died, and Judah told her that she would give him another son. And he didn't, right? So he tried with Onan, right? But that didn't work out. But he didn't fulfill his duty. Tamar had to trick him to get a child because he didn't give him his son when he was of age, right? Boaz joyfully fulfilled his duty. So the juxtaposition of the two kinds of same situation, right? Of this fulfillment, but of the levirate law, levirate marriage. But Boaz joyfully fulfilled his duty. And Perez was the offspring of Judah and Tamar, that would continue the line of Judah to David and ultimately to Jesus. And Obed, in our story, is the offspring of Boaz and Ruth, who would continue the line of David and Jesus. We get a little deeper into this. I got ahead of myself earlier, but you're right. Judah commanded Onan to fulfill his duty. He was an older son that was still there. He'd already lost one son because he was evil. Well, Onan disobeyed God, didn't fulfill his duty to Tamar, and God took his life. I thought that was interesting how it, think about the nearer kinsman who didn't want to fulfill his duty because it would impair his inheritance. So he refused. He was okay when it was just the land that he had to buy, but then Boaz says, oh, and by the way, you also got to take Ruth and fulfill the line of Naomi's family there, Elimelech's family. And oh no, that'll impair my inheritance. So he refuses. And that's where, again, Boaz faithfully and joyfully agrees to do both. And so just thinking through those comparisons of those two stories and how Boaz acted faithfully in that regard, where Judah did not. And it's no wonder that, and it's interesting that the genealogy in the book of Ruth, it starts with Perez, right? Perez, the offspring of Judah and Tamar. And then we go through, and there you can see Salmon, who fathered Boaz, okay, and then Boaz, Obed, right? So again, thinking about the timeline in your head, there's a lot of Salmon, during the time of the fall of Jericho with Rahab, and Boaz at this time, then to get from Obed to Jesse to David, I mean, it's not a very far thing, so you got to think through that timeline there. Michelangelo put that up there. You've got Salmon, Boaz, and Obed up there as part of his artistry. And then we'll take a look at, here's another timeline. You guys can't, if you can't see that, you'll be able to catch the slides when they come later. But again, Salmon up here with Rahab and Boaz with Ruth down there through to Jesse and to David. And then you'll see you've got the sons of David, Solomon and Nathan, right? Out of the line of Solomon is Joseph, the father of Jesus. And out of the line of David's son Nathan is Mary, right? So that's why you get two different genealogies in the Gospels we've seen. There's just a different look at it. If you can't read it, you'll see it later. But the top section is the Nathan line of David's son that leads to Mary. The bottom section is this section here is the Solomon line that leads to Joseph. So you've got Jesus, the double Davidic line there. We'll call that. I'm sure that's a theological term somewhere, but the double Davidic line. So you see the importance, right? Again, I just as you're thinking through that genealogy and just thinking through the story of Ruth, just the continuation of the line of David in these ways, not just going back to Rahab, right, but also to going back through Ruth. And continuing the line of Judah, which ultimately is going to lead to David, who's ultimately going to lead to Jesus through that. And of course, we don't want to miss the inclusivity of that line as well, right? You've got a Gentile prostitute, Rahab, and you've got a Gentile Moabite woman in Ruth, who are in the line of David and Jesus. It shows the inclusivity of God's salvation for all, and every tongue, tribe, and nation. So there's that aspect of it too with Ruth as well that we want to look at, or remember as we're reading through that. All right, let me jump to a couple of takeaways. Again, I said at the beginning, right? It's a simple story. It's a beautiful story. and there's some great truths in it, these general principles that we can take away. The first is, right, faithfulness brings blessing. Faithfulness brings blessing. You see that in Proverbs, right? A faithful man will abound with blessings. God is going to reward obedience and faithfulness. It may not always come right away, right? You saw there was a decent amount of time, years, that Naomi and it was probably suffering with the death of her husband and the death of her sons, and then getting back. But the faithfulness of Naomi and the faithfulness of Ruth was ultimately blessed, and we see that you know, as a general principle in God's word. We don't know when it always comes, and it may not come until, you know, we die and go to heaven, but sometimes we get those earthly blessings as well, and I think we can all attest to that in our lives, the faithfulness of God. As we were faithful to him, he has shown himself faithful to us as well, taking care of us. None of us are without need or lack. We have food on our table and clothes on our back, so those are great things to thank God for and be mindful of, and hopefully spur you on to continue in faithfulness and obedience in good times or bad. And speaking of that, perseverance brings blessing. These are two sides of the same coin, right? We're faithful because we don't leave, right? We stick with it, right? We persevere. But perseverance has a lot to do with in those troubled times, right? We can be, it's easier to be faithful, probably. It doesn't hurt us as much or make us doubt as much when it's good times that we're faithful in. But we have to persevere in those difficult times. I pulled this from James 1:12. Like, blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. There is blessing in perseverance through those difficult times, and we see that again illustrated in the book of Ruth, as God has blessed them in so many ways throughout that story, as they go from that destitute emptiness at the beginning of the book and move to fullness, and it's a result of their faithfulness to God and to His Word, and we see that in Naomi and Ruth and in Boaz, and it's just a great portrait of what faithfulness and perseverance and the blessing that God provides through that to us in our lives. So I hope those are good takeaways for you. Let me pray for you, and we'll finish up here. Father God, thank you so much for this great little book of Ruth. I know when we read it in our daily Bible reading, we get through it in a day, but I hope that we would take a little bit more time just savoring the truths that go on in this great little story. God, I just pray that we would be inspired to be that much more faithful and obedient and in our lives to you, and to persevere in those times of trouble. God, we know that you are with us. You will never leave us nor forsake us. You don't tempt us beyond what we can bear when we're in the midst of our trials. So God, we are grateful for those truths. We are grateful for your faithfulness and, of course, your steadfast love for us. God, as we think about Palm Sunday today, as we approach this Easter week, God, we are so grateful for the redemption that we have in your Son, and this great illustration of redemption that you've shown us in the book of Ruth. May we be forever grateful and just profoundly just appreciative of how you have saved us and you take care of us, God. And we pray all these things in your Son's precious name. Amen.